אהלן.
בכיף שבחרתם לשמוע את החקולטה, ההסקט של הפקולטה לחקלאות מזון וסביבה של האוניברסיטה העברית בירושלים. הפרק הזה הוא עוד פרק מיוחד, הוא הוקלט בזמן מפגש של זוכת פרס וולף לשנת 2022, פרופסור פמלה רונלד מאוניברסיטה של קליפורניה בדייוויס, מפגש שלה עם תלמידי מחקר וסטודנטים של הפקולטה. הקלטנו את זה כפרק, והוא כמובן באנגלית, כי השיחה הייתה באנגלית. אני מאוד מאוד ממליץ לשמוע, זו הייתה שיחה ממש ממש מעניינת. ועכשיו אני אעבור לאנגלית בשביל ההקדמה העקרונית. So hi everyone, and thank you for choosing to listen to Hakulta, the podcast of the Faculty for Agriculture, Food and Environment of the Hebrew University of Jerusalem. This is a special episode recorded during a panel with the new Wolf Prize laureate, Professor Pamela Ronald of UC Davis, who gave a talk at our faculty and then was nice enough to come meet some of the graduate and non-graduate students of the faculty, and we had a nice conversation which we also recorded here. So without too much further ado, I'm happy to share the recording of this wonderful talk that we had. It was recorded live, and that had some effects on sound quality, for which I'm very sorry, but I think it's still worthwhile and very, very cool. And I want to take this opportunity to also thank Pamela and everyone else who participated in the panel. And if you're not yet subscribed to the podcast, now is a good time to do so, and enjoy. Hi everyone. First of all of you in the back, please move to the front row. This is also being recorded to the podcast, the Hakulta podcast. So those of you who are not yet subscribed, grab a sticker on the table there and also please subscribe and listen. And importantly, because this is being recorded, we need everyone to speak into a microphone. That goes for us as much as them. You'll get one. It's in Hebrew.
Got it, thank you.
We're not internationally recognized yet. So we'll get started. We will give as much room to your questions as possible. Please have questions ready. I forgot to introduce myself. I'm Shiran, the host of the Hakulta and a PhD student in Shuki Saranga's lab. And yeah, Rotem.
Hello everyone and thank you for being here. I am Rotem. I'm a PhD student at Idan Efroni's lab. I'm studying resource allocation in root-tip regeneration, and I'm also a part of the PhD forum. I'm more than honored to introduce Professor Pamela Ronald, the winner of so many accolades, with the most recent one being the Distinguished Wolf Prize Award. Amongst her many scientific advancements, she and her team, as she said in her lecture, were able to isolate the XA21 gene, which allows resistance to Xanthomonas oryza, and the SUB1 gene, which allows tolerance to complete submergence of rice, which is a big concern in India and Bangladesh, greatly affecting yield. Besides her scientific work, she's a great advocate of sustainable farming. And she works a lot in explaining genetic engineering to the general public and policymakers. So thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me. Thank you all for coming.
We have prepared a few questions, but feel free to dive in and divert the conversation to any directions you'd like. And that goes for everybody. And I do encourage you to ask questions, as many as you can, because this is a great opportunity. So if it's okay, I'll start. Your early academic career took you in many different directions, and I see that you're coming back to these directions once again. You studied mycorrhizal interactions in pines and a little bit with the tomato and host pathogen relations in tomato and pepper. And then you shifted into rice. So I wanted to ask you, what made you do the switch, the shift, and what made you come back and look at after so many years?
Yeah, well, I became interested in plant biology because probably I spent a lot of time in the mountains backpacking, looking at plants, learning about plants, so I wanted to learn about plants. But I also was interested in food and farming. My father's a refugee, so we had that sense of, okay, we have this privileged position, kind of stable situation politically and economically when I was growing up, so let's see if we can use that to give back somehow. So for me, sort of what happened is I went from plants to food, interested in trying to reduce pesticide use, learning about resistance genes. Thank you. And then I went to graduate school to work on a specific plant microbe interaction and with peppers and tomatoes. That was with Brian Staskowitz, so it was kind of at the beginning of understanding the molecular mechanisms of how plants and microbes correspond. And then when I moved to my postdoc, I did think a lot about what I might want to do, and that's when I shifted to rice, because peppers and tomatoes are important for salad, but rice is a staple food. So I wanted to work on a crop that we could potentially make contributions that would affect many farmers. And it also was fascinating to me learning about rice culture, rice biology. So that was sort of my procession, step by step. Probably the same with many of you. You know, you start something, little thing interests you, you pursue it, and then you move to something else. Does that answer your question?
Usually when the public media discusses new scientific discoveries, they always end that it will take 5 to 10 years to reach any sort of real world implication. So I was wondering if you can describe the process that you went through during these 5 to 10 years, so from the idea and discovery all the way to having cultivars growing in farmers' fields.
Yeah, well, the credit really goes to Dave McKill at UC Davis. He's at UC Davis now. We met at Cornell. He worked at the International Rice Research Institute, and he worked at UC Davis. So the idea really came from the farmers. The farmers came to the International Rice Research Institute. They said, we're losing crops to flooding. So researchers there at the Institute were looking for genetic variation in wild. They found these old rice varieties that had this trait. So I think one reason it went very fast is because while we were isolating the genes, so we were doing the molecular genetics, Dave McKill was already starting to carry out integration of this gene. And then once we had the gene, you can do positive and negative selection, and he used a marker-assisted breeding strategy, which is very efficient, very fast. It's not regulated, so that's something probably we're all aware of. There's so many regulations about genetic engineering. So if we had taken the gene and put it in through agrobacterium-mediated transformation, there would have been a lot of delays. But because it was bred through marker-assisted breeding, there were no regulatory delays. And the other really key aspect was that the International Rice Research Institute for many, many years has had already established collaborations with rice breeding stations in India, in Cuttack, and Bangladesh, the Bangladeshi Rice Research Institute. So there was already, those partnerships were already formed. And so when Dave developed the new varieties, they could be quickly tested at the International Rice Research Institute. They could be tested in Bangladesh and India. By breeders there. They could be backcrossed to breeding lines that were important for Bangladeshi and Indian scientists, and they could be field tested. So this was all going on really at the same time. So one of the reasons it went so fast is that we had a robust international structure for rice breeding already in place.
I'm actually surprised that you, about the regulatory barrier, I'm surprised that problem so big that affects so many people will still go through the same kind of psychological barrier of, had it gone through agrobacterium, it would have been an issue. Do you think it's really the case? Do you think farmers in developing countries who depend on crops for sustenance will really care if it went through molecular methods or traditional methods?
I don't think the farmers care at all, but the political parties care. And so just the classic case is golden rice, right? This gene was this pathway and engineering was developed at the very beginning of my career. And right when I was starting, I was really inspired meeting Petrikis and Peter Beyer and their efforts to engineer rice plants for higher levels of beta carotene, which is very important for young children in many developing parts of the world. It's estimated that 500,000 children go blind every year because they lack of vitamin A, and half of the children die. So you would think of all the projects you could think of that this would be, the public would support this project, but there's so much political opposition to this project that it was just this year that finally farmers have access to that seed. And so that's a very long time, and it's simply because it's genetically engineered versus conventional breeding. So it's changing, things are changing, but it's astonishing how slow it has been.
And do you think that the fact that the source of this gene was from a wild rice cultivar has any other shades to this? So if it came from a distant relative as opposed to wherever the golden rice gene came from, do you think people see shades? Does it matter, or is it just the actual methodology that matters?
You know, this is what seems so disappointing, because I think that many sort of anti-biotechnology people maybe don't understand even the technology, but they're against it anyway. And so it is just the methodology that most of the opposition has been towards the methodology and not towards the product. I mean, I don't think anyone is concerned that there's rice with higher levels of vitamin A. And in fact, some of the antibiotechnology opposition, one of the arguments they make is do it another way. But it's hard, right? Yeah. So for scientists, we're sort of open to technology, whatever appropriate tool to get to a public good that's going to benefit people and farmers. I think as scientists, we're very open to that. But there is this sort of barrier with the having the public understand and who's going to communicate to the public. So I think your podcast is great, because more and more scientists are communicating directly to the public, and that's terrific.
One last follow-up to this subject. I mean, the same people who produced the graphs you showed, and Sharoni also discussed about the rise in population and the need to produce more food, are you aware of any funding that goes through educating people to not be afraid of DNA just because they don't understand what it is?
Well, in the United States, we have some of our federal grants, the National Science Foundation. So if you apply for a very fundamental scientific project, they also want you to do some sort of public engagement. And so some scientists do have programs funded to go into schools, to talk to people, maybe to make a podcast. There is not a lot of dedicated funding for that. And there are a lot of groups trying, but it's never a month. There's just this massive amount of misinformation. Of course, it's not only plant biology, it's other aspects of politics that we won't need to talk about. But this large amount of misinformation is something I think society has to grapple with, because consumers have a hard time telling what is real evidence-based information versus what is sort of just scary tactics, maybe trying to sell you a vitamin. So it's very complicated.
One of the growing, I think, trends here in the, let's call it first world, let's make the transition, is organic farming, and you wrote a book with your husband, your partner, Tomorrow's Table, and you argue there that organic farming with a combination of genetic engineering is basically the future of agriculture. And I want to ask you what constitutes organic farming for you, because there's a debate about the actual definition of organic farming. And also, do you see any limitations with providing as much food with organic practices?
So organic farming in the United States, and I'm sure in Israel, is very precise definition. It does not allow genetically engineered crops. So organic farmers are not allowed to grow genetically engineered crops. So what we try to do in our book, but organic farming is, you know, a very small percent of the calories, less than 1% globally. So we're looking at the other 99% of farming. So we we don't think we can change the organic certification. I mean, it's really set. And now one of the biggest aspects is the fact that modern biotechnologies are not used. So I think that it's probably not going to change. But the other 99% of farming can move towards more sustainable approaches and can borrow, already is borrowing approaches from organic farmers, such as crop rotation, enhancing soil fertility. So some of the principles of organic farming can be applied to other aspects of agricultural systems. And so that's sort of the way we're thinking about it. And certainly modern biotechnologies, whether it's genetic engineering or genome editing, are going to continue to be very, very important.
Shiran and I represent two different approaches in plant science. So the one of, if we'll make the distinction is, Shiran is more practical, agricultural oriented, and I'm more basic science. So we wanted to ask you, which direction do you recommend us as young PhD student wanting to change the world? What do you think will make a greater impact when asking to to feed the world?
Well, it's a hard question. Well, I think that we all have to do what interests us most, right? Because that's going to drive you to come to work every day. So you absolutely need to go where you're most interested and what intrigues you. And like all basic science, you can't really predict in 20 years what's going to have the biggest impact. So I think number one is to do really good science, rigorous science. Look for mentors that support you. And I think what happened with me is I wanted both, you know, very greedy. And I thought that, okay, well, let me do my basic science in rice, because then if I'm lucky, we will discover something that will be applied. And that's kind of what I did. I sort of, I moved to rice with the hope that something would come along. I mean, and it did. I still remember when Dave McKill walked into my office and he told me about the problem with flooding in South and Southeast Asia. And he said, do you want to work on this project? He said, of course I did. I mean, I was really excited. He said, oh, I wasn't sure if you were only interested in basic science, you know. But, and so that brings you in contact. I learned a lot about rice genetics from Dave McKill. I got even more involved with the International Rice Research Institute. And so it, you know, as you move along in your career, you have these opportunities. And certainly when you're a student or a postdoc, sometimes you see someone and you hear a talk like I gave today, and it seems like, wow, you know, that was all planned out. And but really, you don't have to do everything at once, because you're going to live, hopefully, long, productive lives. So you can do different things during that time. Yeah.
Thanks. From the agricultural side of things. Do you think the problems should arise naturally from, like what happened here, with problems from farmers getting solved by using basic science, or should we do predictive work to try and anticipate which problems are going to be there and try and work towards them, or just the general understanding of how things work?
That was good. Well, I think we need to do both. I think this submergence tolerance project is a really good example of farmers saying, hey, we have this problem, and then scientists looking for technologies that could be applied to that problem. But certainly it can work the other way around, and there's a lot more of sort of predictive biology, predicting what farmers are going to be struggling with even 10 years from now, and then trying to get ahead of it. So I think we need everything. Yeah.
I might follow up just a little bit on this. So how much do you, from kind of your position working on the type of projects you do, how much of a crossover do you see from basic science being done on model organisms, plants in our case, and actually reaching a sort of real effect outside? So do you see a proper allocation of amount of research being done on model plants and on crops, for instance? And I'm excluding rice from model plants for this purpose.
Yeah, well, it's a hard question. I mean, I think when the Rabidopsis community started, and of course in all the grant applications, scientists had to say yes, and we're going to apply this immediately to crops, right? And it's taken a very, very long time. haven't maybe seen a lot of direct applications, but I think it's definitely starting now. And genome editing makes it much more direct because, and all the genome sequences, right? So now if you have a very interesting effect in Arabidopsis, you can try to edit that gene in other crops. And so that's certainly starting. I think it's the beginning again of a whole new type of breeding, and Arabidopsis and other models will continue to be really very important. Yeah.
So another kind of plant questions we had goes back to what you said before, is how do you see our role, and I'll exclude the podcast out of it, our role as scientists on the divide between discovery and the social implications of our science. So how much do you think we should be involved in what's being done with our research? And that goes to what you did with the benefits of your discoveries.
Yeah, I'll just say for us, I really was a basic research scientist, but with a lot of interest in food security and global issues, but I wasn't really involved or engaged in that community or doing much public engagement. But what happened was we started seeing how agriculture was covered in the newspapers and how biotechnology was starting to be covered and organic farming. And we felt like there needed to be a voice from geneticists and farmers, especially farmers. It's very rare to have farmers' voices in the public. It's still quite surprising. Well, they're busy. So that sort of motivated us to write this book. And we hadn't really done that much speaking to the public until that book came out, and then we had opportunities. So I think, again, especially for students and postdocs, you're really busy, especially if you have families, right? You can't do everything. And so you need to pick what works for you. And I think it is true that you want, if you're working on a PhD, it's really nice to get that PhD, right? If you have time and talent, for example, to do a podcast, it's very, very impressive and wonderful, but not everybody is going to have the bandwidth to do that, or even necessarily the comfort talking to broad audiences, but maybe that will come later. And so I think you just, it's hard, science is hard, and so you have to give yourself a lot of leeway and patience, and you don't need to all start podcasts while you're students.
you can take over my role, I'm leaving,
so yeah,
there's an open position to as a host.
Yeah, but you could start, I think what's really nice is to start with your families, right? So my father, I don't think he ever had any science. Like he was, a refugee from Europe and getting kicked out of all these schools. And then I don't think, he still, even though I probably explained to him the difference between a cell and a protein and what is DNA. I mean, he could never, I think he's a brilliant guy, but he could never understand this. He didn't have basic education. So it was pretty fun for me to talk with him and work with him. He edited my book, our book, a lot. He spent so much time on that book. And I was just so impressed because, he just really did it out of love and curiosity. But he was probably the most helpful person because he caught all the jargon. You got to explain this better. So I'm a little teary-eyed because we just lost him 3 weeks ago.
So for your loss.
Yeah.
You saw the implications of your explaining. I mean, did you see did you happen to see the mind shift, the effect you had on people after explaining? Did people come up to you and say, oh, now I'm not afraid of genetic engineering anymore, I'm pro? Or after your TED talk, or after explaining, you always give the example of BT eggplant and BT cotton, and people are starting to, are they coming up to you and say, I'm not afraid anymore from this stuff?
You get kind of all kinds of things. I would say, somebody gave me this number once, and it seems to fit. You have 30% of the people in an audience, no matter what the subject is, they're never going to change their mind. But there's 70% that are really open. And so I've learned to speak to those 70%. So if even sometimes if you're talking about biotechnology, you can, there can be a lot of emotion and questions, kind of angry questions, and then you have to remember, well, that person obviously is never going to change their mind. They don't really want to know, but the other 70% that are listening maybe do want to hear your answer. And I do find that especially giving specific examples helps a lot. So talking about GMOs is just terrible. The conversations don't go anywhere because that term means different things to different people. But if you talk about a BT eggplant in Bangladesh and farmers don't have to spray insecticides anymore, people really, oh, you know, explain that more. They get curious because it's a very specific example.
So don't call it a zombie plant. Just yeah. Name the gene.
Yeah, and the trait and yeah. The benefit. Right, right.
I think we're going to maybe ask for questions from the audience.
Thank you so much. My name is Rita Namaweje. I'm a plant science student doing my secondia. I would like to ask, it's a bit different from research. It is more of personal advice. We do a lot of research, we do a lot of experiments, but as you, a person, you have reached to that point of winning a prize, I would like to know what pushes you or what is that you have that you do not lose hope, because there's a lot of work, amidst all the hard work, you get so many setbacks. So what is that pushes you to reach your goal?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's your colleagues, right? I mean, and students, like right now, of course, we all get very discouraged about climate change, especially in Israel and California, where we have water issues, and California, we have fires. So it's easy to get discouraged, but then you meet younger people and they're really motivated. And you just know that if there's enough younger people working on these problems, that there will be breakthroughs. I think there's no doubt about that. So I try to focus on that. And then when there's setbacks in science, as I mean, obviously there are, experimental science is challenging. Many experiments fail. Maybe 90% of our experiments fail. I don't know. You just keep going. But in every case that I think of where I was just so discouraged, there was a person, right? And it could have been a family member. At one point, it was even a child. One of my children encouraged me, husband, and then colleagues. I mean, it's just tremendous how that community is really important, especially scientific colleagues, because they understand in a way that other colleagues cannot understand. Yeah.
You hear me? Hi, thank you for the talk. It was really interesting. I'm actually coming from the field of microbiology, and I wanted to ask, where do you see actually the microbes in the surroundings in the context of, I guess, regulatory-wise, maybe engineering bacteria that can help support plants in resisting plant pathogens? Is it harder regulatory wise if you're engineered bacteria than like in plants genomically engineered? Is there a difference in the politics ways, I guess?
Yeah, so engineering bacteria is going to be very important as well, and how those are regulated, I don't really know. I mean, my first sort of introduction into the difficult politics was Steve Lindau. I don't know if you remember these ice minus bacteria. And he engineered bacteria that when they colonize a plant, the tomatoes, they won't freeze at a certain temperature. So the idea was you'd spread them out in the field, and in a sense, it'd be a protectant. But there was a lot of incredible politics and protests. So that was my first exposure. This is 35 years ago. And I don't think it's changed that much. But I think just ignore all the politics and do the work and get the really good ideas and get the bacteria out there, because there's so much going on with microbiology and metagenomics, and people are looking at populations of microbes that might be maybe able to add to soils or to plants to either protect them from drought or you know, ideally sequester carbon. So there's it's really just at the very beginning, and so I think it's a really exciting area. Does that answer your question? Yeah.
That actually could be a cool way to circumvent all of the political issues, because you can't really see germs, so they're less scary if you just, you know, if you do the genetic engineering on them and you get an effect on the plant, and basically you did nothing wrong with the plants, just, you know.
Yeah, you're not eating. You know, there's this ceiling. If a plant is genetically engineered and then you're eating it, it's something that's going to harm you. But maybe because it's one step removed, that it will be less frightening to people. But I think it all depends on how scientists are engaging and policymakers are engaging. Yeah.
Hi. Thank you for your talk. It was interesting and inspiring. It's a follow-up question about her question. My name is Alex. I'm a PhD student in the Agricultural Research Organization, study plant and bacteria interactions. I heard about your work in the beginning of the presentation. It was very inspiring, of course. And my question is, how do you keep your compass about decision making in your professional work? It's like about 30 years of work, and you need to decide to make decisions about which way to go. What is the right decision of your professional track?
Yeah, well, that's a very good question. I mean, there's so many aspects. You know, bringing good people into the lab is really important, and I would say that that's probably the most important, because when you have lab meetings, people are helping each other and really good ideas. The hardest thing is dropping projects. Still, it's so hard to drop projects, but you have to. Sometimes it's been maybe 6 months, 1 year, 2 years, 3 years, and you know, we're not making progress, and we don't know, sometimes you don't know why. And sometimes it's better for the student to switch to another project that might be more productive. That's really challenging, and I think those decisions can only be made, you know, in discussions with the students and the postdocs, like, well, what else can be done instead, maybe need to shift. Those continue to be very difficult for me, but over the years. So maybe an example is this new carbon sequestration project. I was a member of the Innovative Genomic Institute, get to know people, have some time to brainstorm. They have a really good development team that's raising money. And it was very easy for me to say yes. I'd like to contribute to that, because for me, some of the criteria is, can we move forward on something we want to understand? So this PSY peptide, we see we're really obsessed trying to understand, well, why does the microbe produce it? We still don't really know what the advantage is to the microbe. So that fundamental question drives us. And so this project will help us answer that question. But then also it brings me into contact with microbiologists, really excellent people working on photosynthesis. So personally, it's very satisfying to be able to learn more, and then also, you know, to have one big project contributing to the public good in the last 20, 30 years. I have 30 years left. Okay, maybe 20. That draws me too. So at different points in your career, it's going to be different things, I think, that drive you to start a new project or drop a project.
As a student, as a person who studies like plant and bacteria interactions, I read a lot of the struggles that bacterial academic businesses went through to make a commercialized product. And it has a lot of setbacks, and it's a very difficult and complex procedure. So if you could give me an advice on what field should we focus to make better products, bacterial products, or maybe other products that will benefit farmers and benefit agriculture and human beings.
Yeah, I think in Israel and the United States and other places in the world, there's a lot of startups trying to develop, you know, microbial mixes, for example, that will affect plant productivity or affect nitrogen uptake. And so I really admire that entrepreneurial aspect. Some startups are able to attract a lot of money. And so in a way, you can go a little faster, but then there's all those pressures that you have to really show your progress for the market, which can be challenging because it's you have to take a risk. Like, I have this approach, I think it'll work, or this set of bacteria, and there is a lot of failure still. Yeah, we still don't. I still think we don't have any microbial mix that can be applied to plants that have a real clear effect on any type of productivity. Maybe I'm wrong, but I we'll get there, right? And so we do need a lot of people working just to basic research and applied to do that.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Bar. I'm a student. I wanted to take us back a few minutes when you talked about the good science and how we as scientists or scientists to be can expose the population to GMOs and like talk about those kind of subjects. And the way I'm feeling it right now, that all the essays that I'm reading, all the things that other scientists, PhDs, postdocs posted are very not accessible. So a lot of the publics are afraid of what they don't know. And when I, you said that the first thing to do is to start with your own family. When I want to send to my father, for example, an essay about GMO, and he's starting to read it, and they say, I don't understand anything. Yeah. And me as a future scientist, it's kind of a trade-off for me, because if I'm gonna be a public scientist, which is explaining everything I'm doing to the public, so I kind of have this feeling that I'm gonna be less valid to the other scientists in my community. And I wanted to hear your opinion about what is the trade-off between explaining your work to the public and still be considered as good scientists in our communities.
Yeah, that's a good question. Thanks for coming. So the first part of the question is, you know, I agree, there's still not much publicly accessible material. It is changing, at least in the United States. Some of our funding agencies and associations are really trying to put out clear material that the public will understand. But that's sort of what happened with my husband and I. We're like, people don't understand what organic farming is or even what farming is. We had to even go back a step. There wasn't even not much known about how farmers farm. If you're an agricultural country, maybe more people understand, but Davis is very agricultural, but we're right near the San Francisco Bay Area and nobody's farming in the Bay Area. So 60 miles away, people don't even really know what a fruit, a flower, a seed, or what's going on. And so what happened to us, also, we thought, oh, there's nothing written, so we wrote it. So that's what you have to do. You can start with writing something for your father that you know he'll understand. And it's really kind of fun. And then if you understand it, then you can send it to the newspaper. Or you could participate in the podcasts. Just start slowly with what you're interested in communicating and who's your audience? Because, you know, our fathers are a different audience maybe than a politician. Start wherever it is you're most interested in. And then in terms of being seen as a scientist, I think it doesn't detract from being seen as a scientist really at all. And there's, you know, of course, we still have to do our scientific work, publish our papers. But what's also fun is just to communicate when you write your paper, even your first paper, is to try to communicate to the public what you discovered or why it matters. And a lot of people are doing Twitter threads about their papers, and it's really a great way to communicate. It could be to your audience could be scientists, but it could be people that are non-scientists. So it's all, you know, you find that balance, I think, by experimenting, really. Or you might go to a school to talk to kids and really enjoy it. And then you'll want to do it again. Or maybe you won't like it. Maybe you're a person, a more quiet person that doesn't like to be in front of people, but maybe you like to write. or create a game for kids. So I think it's just a lot of experimentation, and you get better and better at it, right? You definitely don't have to know, have everything be perfect. And there's always a question, you're like, oh, I haven't thought of that. Then you go back and you think of a way to answer that and communicate that, and then it's an iteration. Yeah, you should do it.
Yeah, I just, the Twitter thing is so important. I've just recently started really going on Twitter, and it's wonderful. I had to say it. It's true, and that's the way. It's just use your social media accounts. And we have a second problem here because we have to communicate it in Hebrew as well. But do it. It reaches farther than you expect, faster than you expect.
Yeah, and just be careful because social media is addictive. So you have to get rid of all the people talking about politics or games or movies. You just gotta clean up your thread. Only do science, or otherwise your mind will be even more polluted than we already are.
Hi.
And I'm not sure I'd recommend anybody joining any social media because once you're on, it's very hard to get off. And
Or do any work.
It takes a lot of time. Yeah. So be careful.
Yeah. Okay. Hi, Pamela. Thank you for the talk and for this meeting. It's really an honor to meet you. My name is Rotem, and I'm actually not a plant scientist. I'm an animal scientist. And I want to ask you sort of a personal question. So what do you think the most important characteristic for a scientist in order to become a great scientist?
Oh, good question. Well, I could tell you the hardest thing for some people is forgiving yourself for messing up. You know, I mean, of course we all mess up, and then some of us have imposter syndrome where we're like, oh my gosh, they're giving me the Wolf Prize, they don't really know me, and so you have to just do it anyway, right? So there's all this psychological baggage that we all carry around, and you have to recognize that everybody has it, right? We're all, oh, my experiment didn't work, I'm such a terrible scientist, or oh, I made a mistake communicating to that audience, oh, I'm terrible at this. You know, you just have to like roll on again. And so for me personally, that's been, you know, very challenging, I would say. Changing projects is very hard, right? So there's like this, you have to be persistent, but then sometimes you have to still drop something. And so those are important characteristics. And I think leaning on your peers, we all help each other a lot. Yeah. Well, what do you all think? What is the most important characteristics? Like, Saul, what's the most important characteristic?
So this question was addressed to our new dean-elect, Professor Saul Brodmann, who unfortunately did not have access to a microphone at the time. He said that following your heart is the most important thing. He also said that we must not get discouraged, and we must realize that success in science is quite rare and unique when it happens. He also said that, this is why we repeat experiments, because it's very hard for us to believe that they actually succeeded, which was funny to me, and I wanted to give him credit for that joke. I'm sorry that you are unable to hear him, but unfortunately, due to technical issues, that's what's happened. So, take our dean-elect's advice and follow your heart. What a great sentence from a dean-elect.
Pamela, to conclude, in your view, what do you see as a young scientist, next challenges in the field?
You're probably working on the next challenges in the field already that you've thought through a lot. I think one thing I like about this new project is looking at plant, microbe, soil interactions, and you can kind of get this at any level. So probably all of us are working on that. Those of us in agriculture are working on that from some aspect. So I don't want to say that one area is more important than others, but certainly generally these issues of developing disease resistance and drought tolerance and sequestering carbon and communicating with the public and talking with farmers about new practices that they can use so they don't have to burn rice straw, all these are going to be really important going forward.
Thank you all for coming.
Yeah, please join us in thanking Pamela again.
Thank you. Thanks everybody for coming. Come join my lab.
This is a good opportunity to thank Professor Pamela Ronald again and Professor Saul Boldman, our dean elect, and everyone else who participated in the podcast, and my co-host for this panel, Rotem Matosevich Leper, who was incredible and did all of the preparation for our talk. And she's wonderful, and you should totally look her up. She's going to do wonderful things in science. And yeah, thank you all for listening. And if you like listening to this podcast in English, you might go and check our bonus episode where Professor Jenny Cowan-Niffen from Cornell University participated, and she had some cool things to say about soil microbiome and its potential. And yeah, so thank you. תודה רבה לכולם, לכם ולכן, ובבקשה תעשו לנו סאבסקרייב ולייקים ותשתפו, ותודה לגלעד הראל על המוזיקה המקורית. ותודה לכם, להתראות.